Okay, hello everybody, and welcome back to another episode of Not Suitable for Anyone. This is a very big day. It's a red letter day on the podcast. I have my first guest here that is not that he hasn't worked in film, but he hasn't worked on the film that we're going to talk about. He is a fan, like me. You might know him from other places. My guest is the author of several books, including the Abels series, which I encourage you to check out. He is the voice of CinemaSins. He is one-third of this podcast, SinCast, presented by CinemaSins. He's the master of disaster. He's the Count of Monte Fisto. No, wait, that's Apollo Creed. Ladies and gentlemen, it's Mr. Jeremy Scott.
Hey! Thank you for having me.
Hey, Jeremy. I appreciate you coming on, man. I really do.
This is big for me because you have interviewed actual directors of movies. And, you know, now I feel like it's an honor to share the same stage with these people who actually go out there and put their blood, sweat, and tears into the craft of making a film. So I'm honored.
Well, thank you. It's you who honor me by coming on the show. As you know, of course, the listeners, hopefully by now they all know, but maybe having you on or bringing some new listeners. This podcast is all about, underground, underseen movies. We are talking about a layer of cult films on this podcast that are, like sub cult films. They haven't even achieved cult status, much less mainstream status. But today's film, which I'll just go ahead and get out of the way. Today's film is One Cut of the Dead. You've heard us talk about it quite a bit.
Shit, I watched the wrong movie. No, I'm just kidding.
Did you know actually the Japanese title, which I think is better, the Japanese title was Don't Stop the Camera.
Ah, that is a better title, because One Cut of the Dead, I assume they're going for some kind of Romero-like reference right here with the of the dead, right? The Dawn of the Dead. Isn't that why they did that? It's always been an awkward off the tongue kind of a title, even though it makes perfect sense.
Yeah, it makes sense once you see it, and even when I read the title the first time, I said, oh, huh, so they're going to make a zombie movie in all one cut. I was probably like 10 minutes in when I realized that that's what was going on the first time I watched it.
Yeah. Now, are we going to dance around spoilers, or are we going to say, people, get your ass out there and watch this movie and then come listen to this podcast?
Well, let's definitely say people get your ass out there and watch this movie.
For sure.
It's relatively easy to find, I think. There is, in the U.S., there is a Shudder Steelbook Blu-ray, actually Blu-ray DVD combo that you can get. I think it's still available. There are still a few copies of the region-free disc from Third Window Films. And, of course, it's available on the streaming service Shudder, which is only like $5 a month. They're not paying me any money to say that, but it's a great service, and I highly recommend it.
It is indeed. But you still haven't answered my question as to how much I'm going to be allowed to say about this movie.
So I would say from this point forward, there are no restraints on spoilers. So
okay,
absolutely. Let's talk about...
Because if I were to recommend the movie to you, a friend, I would say, you know, it's about the making of a horror movie. Maybe not everything is as it seems. Go in blind after that. But since we've already told these people to go watch it, and they have, and then they've come back to this podcast, we can talk about all the ways this movie's genius instead of just saying it's great, you'll love it, go watch it.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And that's why...
Now, you know more about this movie than I do, so I'm going to be asking you several questions throughout. The first question I want to ask is, do you know, is there any proof that first 35 minutes is actually one take? Or do they cut somewhere in the middle there cleverly?
So, that's a very good question, and I don't know for a fact. I believe that it is, although...
I would believe it.
Yeah, although there are definitely areas, there's some whip pans, you know, and some other areas where, you know, there's a scene where I think somebody, like, walks into a tunnel, like, you go from a brightly lit area to a dark area, where you could hide some cuts. Mm-hmm. but I believe it's my understanding that the entire thing was shot in one take. It took, you know, took a lot of rehearsals and several tries, but I believe that what we're seeing is, you know, one real time.
I think it is. I'm also not a one take purist. When I find out a movie like 1917 has some cuts in there that it just hides, it doesn't take away from the feat of that film, because there are still these massively long takes where there are clearly no cuts. And it's the same with this one. It's presented unlike any movie I've ever seen, because you watch the first 30 minutes and then the credits roll and you're like, what is going on? There's still an hour left. And then you get into, you know, the whole, you back up and you find out this guy's been hired to make this one cut freaking live zombie movie. But a few minutes into that, then this movie's credits roll and there's a title screen at, like, it's gotta be the latest title screen other than the Nolan ones that come at the end of the movie.
Yeah. I clocked it at like 40 minutes in is when the title card drops.
That's absurd.
Yeah.
I've never seen a movie do that. Boy, this movie made me laugh so much. The first time I watched it, I think I laughed less because I was so bathed in the originality, the creativity of it, the balls of it. Because once you get to that last act and you start seeing the reasons for all the awkward pauses that earlier you could chalk up to indie filmmaking or bad acting, and now you have this background reason for why. The second time through, I already knew it was genius, and I just roared laughing at everything. I think my favorite part is the mom, and it's a sequence where you find, I'm sorry if I'm going too far or too fast.
No, that's okay.
But the segment from where you find out from the daughter that she takes her acting too seriously, gets lost in her roles, to where you see the second time of her running outside and jump karate kicking all these zombies that are the first time through in the way, the second time through in the way on purpose. And when she just goes, kicking them, I was almost crying laughing. It's rare that a movie is this impressive on a technical scale, from a creative idea scale, and then just executing the jumps and the laughs all the way across the board.
Yeah, yeah, it absolutely is. So I'm curious to know, your first time through, you know, that during that first 30 minutes, I guess, what's going through your mind as you're watching it?
I'm thinking the conceit is revealed when the zombies attack for real and the director keeps showing up and you realize he's bloodthirsty and that he has set up his actors to actually be in a real zombie apocalypse to get real emotions. That feels like the movie to me. And that's a pretty funny setup. That's a pretty good setup. And he sells it, dude. Every time he pops up and goes, action!
Yeah.
But you think that's the conceit. And that's why I think it's brilliant, is it gives you a very big card early on. And that would be enough. And then when it gives you the other card later, it's just, it reveals itself to be a layered work, much deeper than you realize the first time you're watching.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. It's, so it's a movie about people making a zombie movie, but the zombie movie they're making is about people making a zombie movie.
Yes, exactly. And there are moments where the first time through, the actors pause or say something that seems a little weird. And again, when you don't know what's coming, you chalk that up to just an indie production. Like, it's still a clever idea. It looks like a shoestring budget. That's part of the genius of the film. It looks like they made this for no money at all. And that's why you're so willing to forgive the acting accidents and the camera that lingers too long on the screaming girl. And you're like, okay, it's a super low budget indie production, but then it reveals itself and all the reasons for everything are just freaking hilarious. It takes them forever to get that axe on the mom's head. And that's why girl is screaming for forever. It takes that girl falls off the human pyramid so many times, she could be like a top 10 ESPN sports blooper, but the first time you're watching that rooftop scene where the girl's being, the zombie's encroaching, and then he stops. And then it keeps going, and then he stops. And you're like, oh, this is some weird acting, or some maybe the director had to go pee or whatever. But it just gives you a three or four different layers, man. Yeah. It's one of the best movies I've seen in years. I only watched it because of you. You and some of the other modern horrors guys were raving about this movie on Twitter. And I went and bought it off the, I think the distributor's website. That might be that Region Free one that you're talking about.
Yep.
It's the one that I have. but I've given it to at least three people so far to try and get them to watch it because it's just really freaking clever. I like movies about making movies. They already have me at that. But then when you put so much thought into it, I wonder, now maybe you've seen some commentary. I wonder what came first, right? Like, did he write the reasons that we see in the third act? Like the alcoholic guy throwing up for real instead of fake and then go back? Or did he shoot the first one and just say, pause here, improvise here, and then later on I'm going to figure out the why? I almost feel like he had to work backwards on this, right?
I think you do, and only because of the budget. And I don't know if you happen to know if or if you want to take a guess as to what the budget for this movie was.
Okay, I will take a guess. I would guess $30,000.
That's actually really close. It's okay. It was all the reports I've seen have been around $27,000.
Oh, wow.
And
that's even more impressive then, because it does show you how much of their planning went to rehearsing.
Yeah.
Right? They didn't
pay
big money for effects. They just rehearsed over and over again.
Right. Yeah. You have to have that rehearsed, and I think you have to have all those pieces in place. And you have to know where you're going. On that budget, there's literally no room for error on a $27,000 budget.
No, not at all. I mean, every single dollar is being stretched as far as possible, I think, in that instance. Yeah. Which makes me wonder, again, do you know, and I'm guessing I know the answer, that they shot both the first 35 minutes and the final act at the same time? They didn't shoot it twice.
I don't think so.
You really don't?
I don't. I think that, and the main reason for it is I have seen there's a GoPro cut of the movie.
Mm.
That's just like a bonus feature on some of the Blu-rays. And I've seen parts of it. And I think like the actual like crane shot at the end.
Yeah.
Is actually a crane shot. And the whole thing with the human pyramid was just something they came up with, to be funny. But I don't think they actually shot it that way. So I think they did do it at least twice. But that to me almost makes it as impressive, because when you watch it, it's seamless. And maybe if you get your CinemaSins microscope out and you watch the scenes like side by side, you probably could pick out a few things that are different from the first time through and the second time through. But you would have to examine it at that level. I don't like just watching it. Even having watched it several times, it still looks seamless to me.
What's crazy is planning. I did in college. Let's not make it sound like it's modern. I did live theater in college. I was in a play all 4 years of college. Loved acting. Would have done acting as a career if I thought there was any money in it for people that have middling talent like me. But there was one story I've told on our podcast when we were doing Arsenic and Old Lace, where, which is a fantastic film and play, where the three leads on stage inadvertently skipped over two or three pages of the script. And backstage, we were all wigging the fuck out. Like, hey, can I say fuck on your podcast?
Yeah, absolutely.
So the director, he's not backstage. He's behind the audience in the control booth. But the assistant director and all the stagehands and all the actors are backstage going, what do we do? They skipped this whole section and it's got this key part of it. So I'm playing. Have you ever seen Arsenic and Old Lace?
I haven't.
Oh, it's Capra, too. You would love it. It's my favorite black and white movie. And that's probably not even a line I should draw. That's like film racist. Anyway, So I was playing this cop, and the cop shows up. He's a beat cop, and he shows up at the house throughout this night of the play several times, but not this time. But I knock on the door and walk right in. I'm like, oh, how's it going? And they look at me like, what the hell is this guy doing here? And I grab Tim, the guy that was playing Cary Grant's part, and I take him into the offstage kitchenette. And I go, you guys skipped 2.5 pages. And he goes, we know. And I was like, okay. And I walk back out. There is an electricity to freewheeling it in live performances. I'm sure SNL characters, actors feel this all the time. Because after I went off stage, those three actors somehow incredibly worked all 2.5 pages of that content back into their current conversation and went down as theater legends from my time in college because they rescued that. And this movie really hits that sweet spot for me in that third act when everything is going wrong. Everything just keeps going. And it's not just the director who's having to improvise and go with it. The actors are, the camera operators are. They're like smacking each other on the butts. At one point, one camera operator goes down and the assistant has to pick up the camera and she's a new camera operator. And then she freaking stumbles through the grass and the zombie has to pick her up. And it's just that glorious madcap. Everything goes wrong, but we still somehow pull it off. Really hits a sweet spot for me and reminds me of that one specific play that I did.
Yeah, you know, it's the ultimate, you know, the show must go on kind of story.
They're on live television, man. They can't, there's nothing they can do. Yeah. Like, he's the first time through, he yells at the camera, you keep rolling no matter what. And you'd think nothing of it. But the second time through, they're about to go to a placard. They're about to cut to a, sorry, we have a problem. And he somehow senses this on screen. And he's not talking to the cameraman. He's talking to the control booth when he says, you keep rolling no matter what.
Yeah. But the first time through, you think that it's just part of that director. Like, he wants all this footage captured because this is going to be his masterpiece. Yeah,
exactly. Because you think he's lost his mind.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, it's fabulous. And that's a really tense moment because they are like in the control room. They are like the producer guy is about, he's thinking and he's hearing input. He's like, okay, put the card up. And then it's the daughter at the last minute that comes in and like slaps the guy's hand away. He's about to push the button. And she's like, no, you know, you can jump to this part of the script, bring this guy back as a zombie. And then you're back on track.
Yeah. So. But I do think it's hilarious. They all share a family trait. The mom loses herself too far in the role. Well, the girl did that as the assistant director on that video shoot earlier in the movie. That's why she got fired.
Right.
And once
she
gets some control in this production, she's like screaming at everybody and bossing people around. And then the director loses, like, in the first scene, he completely starts improvising and like venting all of his pent-up frustration at the pretty boy actor. You've been whining since rehearsals. Like, they all like lose themselves in their various roles. And I feel like that's intentional. It's a family trait.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I watched this movie first as part of a film festival, but I was doing remote coverage. So they sent me like an online screener and I was literally just sitting in my office watching it on my computer screen by myself. So I had no way of really, like, I didn't have an audience with around me to sort of validate the way I was feeling, to laugh at the things I was laughing at. So I really kind of went out on a limb in, you know, in my reaction to it. But ultimately I was like, you know what, I'm going to trust my instincts. But I remember like reading stories from people who were in the screening room when they showed it at the festival. And one guy at, you know, 37 minutes in, when the credits start to roll, he got up and walked out and never came back. Like, he just
thought it was over.
He thought it was over.
And you know what? You could give this movie a good review if you did that. I think if you'd look at it as a shoestring budget indie horror movie and you walk out at the 37-minute credit mark and you never realize what's happening, you could still have a really good time. I said that the first time I watched it. The credits started rolling. I didn't know what was happening, but I was enjoying it. I had a big smile on my face. But that's nuts. I think I heard that story too.
Well, when it changes and it gets into that second act, and I didn't know what I was seeing at first. I thought maybe it was like documentary footage, like archival footage. Like, okay, we made this movie, and now we're going to spend the next hour like showing you how we made it. And I literally wrote, okay, we just watched this movie, and now we're going to see how they made the movie. That sounds boring.
Yeah.
like that was my, well, it, yeah, just my instinct.
It doesn't exactly open with a lot of like speed and momentum either, right? Like that second act is pretty slow for the most part, but especially the first 5-10 minutes where it's mostly just seeing his wife do the self, watch the self-defense videos and seeing his daughter get fired from her thing and him being jealous that he doesn't get any attention from his daughter. But I think that's necessary. The first act and the third act are so manic.
Yeah.
You have to have that middle, but it also provides plenty of laughs as you slowly learn about dude's alcoholism for his shaking hand, which will be important, or other dude's irritable bowel syndrome and needing special water. And he's constantly saying, I've emailed about this. He reminds me of the stapler guy in Office Space. Was like, my stapler. I've emailed about this. I can't drink this water. And then, of course, you get to see two completely different actors rehearsing roles that they ultimately won't play. But yeah, the first few minutes of that, it feels like the documentary tacked on to the short film. And that's, again, part of why the movie works is it keeps you off kilter that way.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree with that. There's a lot of stuff that's sort of set up there. It's weird. Because they're paying things off in the first act, and then they're setting them up in the second act, which feels like the payoff, like the whole palm thing with the self-defense.
Yeah.
Like, you feel like, okay, that's the payoff, but then it pays itself off again, like, so many more times in the third act when she's just going nuts.
She does it, like, 2 or 3 times in a row. Like, somebody grabs her, she's like, pum! Somebody grabs her immediately, pum! And if you're not laughing at that point, I don't know what's wrong with you.
Yeah, yeah, no, exactly. It's hilarious. And then the director himself, like, I relate to this guy, because I am this guy. You know, I'm a middle-aged guy. My kids are getting older. In a few years, they're going to go off to college. They're going to start, you know, lives of their own, which is sort of in this position that he is in.
Mm-hmm.
And his producer friend even, like, says, hey, what's that slogan you always use again? And he says, you know, I'm fast, cheap, but cheap. Average.
And it gets him the job.
Exactly.
Don't they immediately say, oh, well, then it's yours? That's a fun scene, too, because he thinks they're joking. Because, honestly, the idea of a zombie network is a pretty good gag to begin with. Like, a whole TV channel devoted just to zombie content is not out of the realm of possibility in this current climate.
Yeah. I'll say it's called TNT.
Or AMC.
AMC, that's the one. I don't watch Walking Dead. So.
But that was a Walking Dead has 5 spinoffs joke, right?
Exactly.
All right, that's what I thought. That's a good gag.
Yeah, but
right.
That's funny. And then they're like, oh, you want to do this live? Which live television is not unheard of, right? NBC does this all the time with their live musicals.
Yep.
But
well, and even I'll date myself right here. Even when I was in college, ER, when George Clooney was still on the show, did a live episode. The entire episode was live.
Really?
They did it twice.
They did it again for the West Coast?
Yeah, they did it again for the West Coast.
That's insane.
They made some kind of mistake on the second one, but the one I saw seemed flawless. Because, again, I think live performance is all about rehearsal, which is why Saturday Night Live is such a crapshoot. They only have a week, and they're probably not even locking scripts until Wednesday or Thursday sometimes, and there's no way to rehearse well enough to not screw up, which is why they screw up all the time and laugh at each other. but, yeah, it's all about rehearsal, baby.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So even that's not far-fetched, but doing that with a zombie show, and he just starts laughing when they pitch him the idea. They're like, oh, good one, that's absurd. And they just stare it back at him stone-faced, and he's like,
says, we're not joking. That lady cracks me up.
Oh, she's the best.
Because when she's actually watching the final product, she digs the hell out of it. Like, even the other executives are like, this is kind of a long take, isn't it? This is kind of weird. And she's like, no.
Well, that was like my favorite part is like when they're showing the girl screaming for like 3 minutes and they're like, it's kind of going on for a while, and they tap her on the shoulder and she's like staring at her phone. She's not even watching the show anymore at this point. She's like, what?
And then they get to the end, and like, this is like every boss you've ever had, right? Because they get to the end, and she's like, oh, we pulled it off without a hitch, and there weren't any problems at all. Good job, everyone.
Yeah.
And it's like, you motherfucker, we've been running around behind the scenes putting out fires left and right.
Yep. Oh, man. What else do we want to say about this movie? We both swig some more liquor.
Yeah, I wrote something down because it's just one of those things that cracks me up is like when they show the little like the little placards when they get to like the script read through.
Yeah,
this scene is also crazy. And like there's the guy playing the director, and you realize that he's ultimately not going to play the director because the director's going to end up playing the director through a set of unfortunate circumstances, but like. In actuality, when you take like that fourth wall step back, you realize that there's an actor who's playing a director, who's playing an actor, who's playing the director.
Yeah, I like the poor. I think it's the AD, the kid in glasses, who at the read through is just trying to like get an autograph from the really famous like. Pretty boy actor, and he's right. Like, I'm in my zone right now. And that poor kid, that AD, is just shit on the whole movie because he gets puked on in the face, which no one told him was coming. And I would have to believe that's a terrible experience. But he has to immediately then get pushed right back into duty as a zombie, and he gets no love, man. He's probably the least loved character in the whole movie, I think. Because everybody's kind of an asshole at some point here or there. But not everybody, but he's definitely not. He just seems like a nice guy who keeps getting shit on.
And you've got that sort of like, so you've got the movie star and then you've got the pop star, right? Those are the two, those are the two leads. And they're sort of treating those guys with kid gloves. And the movie star has all these opinions about like what a zombie can and can't do.
Can't throw an axe. The guy's like, the poor AD after the pop star, the guy storms off. The glasses kid is like, this is the coolest thing my character gets to do in the whole movie, man. And the director's like, I'll talk him into it. I promise I'll talk him into it. He's so serious about his craft.
Yeah. And then he finally sells him on the whole thing by just telling him, hey, you're the star. Everyone knows this is your show.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly, the way you would feed an ego like that. Oh, man, and he's not the star by any stretch, at least not of the finished product. Who is the star of that finished product? I guess it's the girl, right? The pop star girl, because she's the final girl?
She's the final girl, yeah. Like, she goes off script at the end and kills the boyfriend, but...
All right. I guess she's the protagonist or the star of that movie, I guess. Not the protagonist of One Cut of the Dead.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, no, I mean...
Movies within a movie always make it complicated to talk about them.
It is. There was, you know, it was, what was it? You remember the old days? You remember Jack Handy's Deep Thoughts?
Yes.
there was one that he always had, and I always remembered it. I remember it because I saw it, I swear, I saw it like the same week that I watched, I think it was Death Trap. Or something like that for the first time, and the Dad Candy Deep Thought on SNL that weekend was like, "If you ever find yourself in a theater and realize that you're watching a play within a play, just grab onto your seat and hang on for the ride of your life."
Those were the best, man. I miss those completely. Those and the cartoons, the Robert Smigel cartoons. Those were the best.
Yeah.
The ambiguously gay duo.
Oh man. Yeah, that was I think every generation has like an SNL heyday, and it probably corresponds to like the SNL cast that was like that existed when you were 17.
Sure. Sure.
I remember those days.
Oh man, that was a good show. But my dad did not allow that show, but I still watched it.
Was that the one? Yeah, you had a pretty religious upbringing.
I did. One Cut of the Dead would not have been allowed in my house. I can say that much.
my parents paid money to the cable company to not get MTV.
Because, oh,
But I'm sure that my mom is convinced that, you know, that I graduated college and became a lawyer because she blocked Beavis and Butthead when I was 16 years old.
Well, at least you had cable. I didn't have cable. My parents got cable after I went to college. Like, we had antenna. We had over-the-air channels the first 18 years of my entire life. Do you know how many fuzzy, like, snowed-in-looking shows I had to watch?
Oh, Jesus. I know. Yeah, we had those. The first time I got cable, first time we got cable in my house, I think I was like 9 or 10. So I remember the pre-cable day. And then like when I like moved out and like my wife and I first like got our first apartments and stuff, like we couldn't afford cable.
Right.
So,
right.
You know, we had.
That's why a lot of parents don't get cable because they can't afford it. A lot of parents don't get cable because they think it'll warp their children's minds. And, you know, all kids who go without cable have my pity.
Yeah, well, these days, at least, these days, I don't know if you've watched, like, over-the-air television now, because, like, we're cord cutters in my house. Like, I don't have cable, but we have Sling, and I've got Netflix, and I've got Amazon, and all the other shit, so, like,
I'm impressed.
I don't really need to pay, you know, another $90 a month for a bunch of shit I don't have time to watch.
Right.
And, like, the local, like, the shit that my family does like to watch that's on live TV, you know, shit like not Dancing with the Stars. What's the other one? The singing thing. The Masked Singer. You know, that kind of bullshit. Mm-hmm. That's all like on over-the-air TV. Now we have these HD antennas. So
that's fabulous.
The show either comes in or it doesn't. Like, you're not like squinting through squiggly lines to try and figure out what the fuck is going on. Like, it's either there or it's not. But when it's on, it's crystal clear. So
yeah, there used to be like entire lineups from channels that we didn't watch because CBS didn't come in very well on the TV, but right. NBC did, right? Like, yeah. It was crazy.
Well, that Married with Children had that whole bit, right? That was like, you know, Fox viewing positions, and like every family like grabbed a piece of like metal and like held it up.
Yeah, I wouldn't know. Married with Children, I was not allowed to watch. Oh, man.
Yeah, I get it. So yeah, geez, where were we? I lost track.
We were talking about Married with Children. No, I don't think that's right.
But yeah, like he's trying to wrangle the cast, right? And the read through, like that scene cracks me up. Like the first time through, I'm like, what the fuck is going on? But the second time through, it just cracked me up because they're even teeing up jokes in that room.
Yeah.
You know, they're gonna pay off at the end, and even pay off when you rewatch it and you see that first the first act again. It's just manic, like everything's going wrong. Like the girl like brings her like baby.
Who brings a baby? Because he's so quiet. Who brings a baby to a table read? Well, not the makeup girl, that's for sure.
Yeah. And then and then like the director, all they can do is kind of like hang his head, and but something happens to him, and I don't think it would be the same if he didn't end up having to like play the role, because there's a moment, I bumped the mic. I always do that when I'm drunk. There's a moment.
There you go.
Where like the producer, his producer buddy, is like, look, you've already like they're like 2/3, 3/4 of the way through the script. Right, and he's like, "Well, we don't have the big finale," and the producer guy's like, "Well, let's just drop it. It's fine. Like your average is good enough." And at this moment, like he's so like in the moment of creating this thing, that he's like, "No, like we need to fucking do this."
Yeah,
and so at the time I watched this, I was in between business trips to Japan. I made business trips to Japan 2 years in a row.
Oh, wow.
And so I think I'd just gotten back from one, and it was before I went on the next one. On the next one that I went, I actually found there was a film festival near my hotel, and they were selling some One Cut of the Dead merchandise, so I bought it. It's awesome.
Oh, awesome.
But so I had been to Japan, and we went to all these different meetings, like all around, like in Osaka and all around Tokyo. And so like when the guy starts screaming at his boss, that's like, I mean, like you think of like just in America, you think like it takes a lot to like get up the nerve to scream at your boss.
Right.
But whatever you think it is in Japan, like amplify that by like a million.
Right.
Because you can kind of see, like, immediately he sort of, like, realizes that he's, like, out of line, and he bows, and he's like, sorry.
Yeah.
But just to get to that point, you know, it was a big deal.
Yeah, you know, I don't know a lot about it, but I do know that Japan is generally a lot more respectful culture of each other and of at least business and social status. My favorite class, I detour on podcasts. This is what I do. My favorite class in college was I was a speech communications major, and it was about international speech communication in terms of like how different cultures view different aspects of communication. And this is where I learned that like in Germany, everybody is very punctual. If you're not punctual, it's considered disrespectful. In Japan, almost nobody is punctual. That is not how people show respect to each other in Japan. There are many other ways they do it. and that was my favorite class because I was just such a fucking clueless American idiot. I don't think about other cultures very often until I'm like forced to. But I was like, wow, that makes sense. So if I go to Japan and the guy I'm meeting with is 30 minutes late, it doesn't mean he's an asshole. It just means time is a little looser construct there. And I should just chill and wait. And also don't shake hands. Anyway.
But you also pass anything you hand to somebody, like you don't just like stick out your hand like this. You offer it up with two hands, like every
both
like
hands.
With every business card I got, like they hold it with both hands and they hold it with the information like facing you.
Mm.
So that, and you're supposed and you're not just supposed to like take it, thanks, stick it in your pocket and move
supposed
on.
To read
like,
it.
You're supposed to read it and look at it.
Yeah.
And like say then like say their name back. Like, okay, you know, nice to meet you. Now, the thing I would do is in the weeks sort of leading up to the trip, I just learned I taught myself like enough phrases to kind of get by.
Okay.
So I taught myself, you know, sort of how to say hello and, you know, greetings, that kind of thing. Hello, goodbye, thank you, whatnot. So I would always, we would exchange business cards and I would say, you know, I would give them a greeting in Japanese and they would look at me and they would say, oh, you speak Japanese. And I wouldn't answer. No. I would just kind of smile awkwardly and then move on to the next person. So when they're having side conversations, I'm like looking at them intently, like during the meeting, because like, they're having the side conversation in Japanese with each other, and then back of their mind, they're like, wait, can that guy understand what I'm saying or not?
You put enough doubt there.
Right.
You put enough doubt there. That's interesting. I remember my wife has spent a lot of her youth going on mission trips to Native American reservations and had a very big interest in Native American culture. And when we were dating, we went to DC and went to the Native American Museum there, the Smithsonian.
Oh, that's a awesome. Fantastic museum.
It is. I'll never forget the first time she took me to a powwow here in Tennessee. Lots of tribes show up for that kind of event, but we went up to a man to ask. He was in full headdress, and we were going to ask his permission to take his picture, which is a respectful thing to do. You don't just take the picture. And as we were walking up, she says to me, don't make eye contact. And I said, okay. And so I didn't. And then when we left, I was like, what was up with that? And she was like, in his culture, and I don't remember, it's not every Native American culture, and I don't remember which tribe this guy was from, but in his tribe, it was considered actually rude to make eye contact in that setting where we didn't know each other. And it was considered polite not to. And I just think it's fascinating because most of us get so absorbed in our own culture, we don't pay attention to that. So I think it's pretty insightful to bring it all the way back around that you knew enough about Japanese culture to know that the director yelling at his boss, it's the director that yells at his boss. Is that who you said it was?
Yeah.
Yeah. Is a big deal in Japanese culture, a bigger deal than it would be in American culture.
Yeah, that rich. I don't know, for whatever reason, that just sort of jumped out at me, at the time. So and for two reasons, and that was one of them. And then the other reason is, you know, when you get to be, I know that we tease each other about this, but for the kids out there in the audience, you and I are basically the same age.
Okay, I'll take that. That's a compliment to me.
And
I think you just gave me like 3 years there, but well, I'll take it.
So, you know, but when you get to be our age, you do, I mean, they call it a midlife crisis for a reason, right? You look back at what you've accomplished so far, and you think like, okay, is this why I'm here? Is this what I'm supposed to be doing? And when the guy just kind of tells him like, no, your average is fine, like your average is good, and he's like in the middle of creating this, he's in the middle of this really like energetic experience, because he really does come full circle. I'm rambling a little bit, but. When we first see him in the beginning of the second act, when he's shooting like a soap opera or a commercial or something, where like a guy's like crying in a wheelchair.
Yeah,
and like he's not even looking at the monitor. Like the producer guy comes to see him to try and set up this meeting for later on, and he's not even looking at what's happening. And then like a director, are we good to go? And he's just like, yeah, we're fine. Like he doesn't even care. Yeah. And now all of a sudden,
He goes home and his wife says, you said yes, though, didn't you? And he was like, yeah. And she's like, I knew that. You can't say no to anybody. And by the end, he's saying no to his boss. He's saying no directly to his boss. So there's lots of character growth there, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. No, there is. There's a lot. And he's just so swept up in this. He's like, no, we're in the middle of creating something great. But to him, it's not going to mean anything if they don't have their big finale. And he's got to figure out a way to do it.
Yep. Big finale matters.
So, and then this always gets me. I'm not too proud to admit this. This chokes me up.
Oh wow!
Every time I watch it, because there's the scene with him and the drunk guy, right? And the drunk guy's talking about how like his daughter's grown up. She's moved out of the house. She doesn't want to spend any time with him anymore, right?
He says his addiction is keeping him from his daughter. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Because he's got this drinking problem, and he doesn't get to see his daughter. And, you know, and the director starts realizing, like, my daughter's moving out soon. And, like, what if I don't get to see her again? And, like the next, it, like, cut, literally cuts to him, like, crying in a closet.
Yeah. A lot of what he does, including casting that heartthrob, is a lot of this movie is about getting his daughter's attention. And he ultimately gets it by her working on the film rather than the heartthrob boy being cast, right?
Yeah. Well, he brings her along initially, just kind of gets her to come along, and then she gets caught up in it, starts working on the film. And there's this one photo of her, like, sitting on his shoulders when she's a little girl, you know, holding up a camera. And that's what gives him the idea to create this human pyramid. And the two of them like get on top, because that's how they can get, you know, because he's like, we need 4 meters of of elevation, you know, to get the shot, because we have to get the pentagram in the shot with the girl. And, you know, and then like she shows him that photo that she's been carrying around or whatever, like at the end. And then it just goes to a close up of him, and he gets this little smile on his face. And it gets me.
Yeah.
It gets me every time. And so I'll tell you the story. Because like, I don't know if I talk about this a little bit on Twitter. None of the Modern Horrors guys know. I don't know how much like the listeners really know about my day job. You know, I went to engineering school, and then I went to law school, and you know, and so I work in patents.
As you
now.
Do.
as one does. Right. And I work in patents now, and it's sort of a thing, you know, it's a living, as they say. And, yeah, and this is sort of like the baseline thing that most people in my like daily circles know about me is, oh, you know, that's Patrick. He has an engineering degree and he went to law school. And this was about a year ago or something. My youngest son, who just turned 13, and at the time he was turning 11 or 12. And he had to like, oh, that's what it was. He was in sixth grade, and it's crazy now. Like, you don't just go to middle school and high school. There's like all these different choice schools, and they have different specialties. My oldest is in a high school that specializes in business. He's in this whole business program where he's like,
wow.
Yeah, he's like learning like how to use like Microsoft Excel and PowerPoint and all this stuff. But it starts in middle school. Like there's different middle schools you can go to that have different academic programs and stuff. And they have to write an essay about what they want to do with their lives. And I'm like, he's 12.
Yeah.
Like I was like 20 and I still didn't know what I wanted to do with my life. What the fuck? Yeah. The fuck do you mean he needs to write an essay to get into a middle school program?
Jesus.
Like, that's insane. But anyway, it's like, well, you have to get him into this program, because if he goes in just into the regular curriculum, it's like this shithole. of, you know, like kids who just don't even want to be in school and all that shit. And like, you don't want them around that. And like, you at least want them around other kids that also want to learn. So they inspire each other, and whatnot. I'm like, okay, I agree with that. So it's like, okay, here, you have to write this essay about what you want to do. And I honestly, I don't know what to expect. I pick this up and I start reading this essay. And he writes that I want to get into this program because I want to get into a good college to study and so that I can get an engineering degree and then go to law school so I can be like my dad.
I get it now, because the end of One Cut of the Dead is really about, like, he already had her because she's wants to be a director. She wants to go into film like him. Like, she already looked up to him. Reminds me a lot of, for no good reason, of Road to Perdition, where after Tom Hanks gets shot, they go to the old farm, old lady and man's farm. They're watching the kid work with the old man, till the soil, and the old lady says to Tom Hanks, "He's your son, he dotes on you. He adores you." And Tom Hanks has this baffled expression. And she's like, "Oh, you don't see it." And I think that's what this director in this movie, he didn't see it. He didn't see it because he wasn't looking for the right evidence. And by the end of the movie, I think he sees it and gets that there is a bond, a connection. And yeah, man, that's a good story. That'll get you, that'll make you have feels.
Yeah.
Your
yeah.
story. That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah, no, it got me, for sure.
I bet. I
looked at it. I don't remember if my wife was, I don't know if she was home that night or she was out. I don't remember. I sent it to her and I'm like, I don't know what to do. Like and she just wrote back. She just responded. She's like, "You didn't know?"
Aww.
And I'm like, "No, I didn't know." I had heard him say that. I had heard him say like he wanted to study engineering and law, but I just figured like it was because that's what dad does, and you know, we have a nice house and you know and all the stuff. So obviously like that's a like it. I
Not
never,
because
like,
he wanted to be like you.
Right.
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 Right. No. Whereas my kid, my non-existent kid, writing that essay would be, "I want to go to college and get a communications degree. Scrap that and manage movie theaters for about 10 years. Scrap that, manage a grocery store for a year, then do some SEO website work and stumble fast backwards into a YouTube career." That's what my kid's essay would be. Because I want to be like my dad.
Right, right. I will tell you, you are my older son. I don't even know if I've had this conversation with my younger son, but my older son knows who you are. He knows that we're friends.
Oh, that's great.
And he thinks the world of you.
Oh.
He really does.
Why haven't you told him the truth about me yet?
because he's 15 and he's not like completely jaded about the world yet. So
I have a really good friend whose kid came of age as CinemaSins did, and the kid is older now. He's like 20, but there were a few years there where my friend was like, "If you just posed for a picture with him, that would be the biggest moment of his life." And I'm like, "Are you fucking kidding me? Does this kid not know, like, that I pissed my pants in fourth grade at school? Like, I'm not awesome. Like, I'm just a dude who stumbled it anyway. It's never going to be normal for me that people think I'm cool. But you tell your son he's awesome. And you tell the other one to get in line."
No, they're both fans. They're both fans of CinemaSins. Of course, that's the YouTube generation, right? Like they grew up with this. It's just normal to them.
Yeah,
the whole
yeah.
thing is new to me. I mean, even to me, and I feel weird, being a 40-year-old man, and like watching YouTube. And there's still certain things like I do not get, like the gamers, like the ones that just like play through games. On YouTube.
Sure.
I don't understand. My kids, especially my younger one especially, but they both to a degree, they both love it. And I do not get it. Like I don't get, like to me, it's like sitting on the couch watching someone else play a video game. And I'm like, yeah, okay,
now
this
that,
is boring. Is there something else we can do?
I don't know your audience. I don't know your audience. I hope your kids don't listen to this show. But there was a good period of time where a buddy and I had a weekly standing weed and video game night. And usually it was hockey, and we usually played cooperatively on the same team. But when a new Grand Theft Auto or a new Fallout New Vegas or something would come out, one-player games, we would take turns until we died and passed the controller. And I got to tell you, if you introduce drugs to the scenario, it can be quite fun to watch people play video games. I do think YouTube in general is a lot like video games in that we grew up with it, us and those Gen X and I guess, was it Gen Y that came after us? Okay, are you Gen X? I'm Gen X.
I'm Gen X, but just barely.
Okay. So, you know, we grew up playing video games, and it took 15 to 20 years of the boomers going, video games are for kids. Video games are for kids. And now there are, nobody really thinks that anymore. There are gamers in their 30s, 40s, and 50s, and we just accepted that. We grew up with it. We still do it as adults. It's not Play-Doh. It's not something we outgrew. It's still fun. And I think YouTube is a lot like that, depending on when you grew up. It's not a fad. It's not something that your kids' age are gonna go away from. It's just part of consuming culture, right?
Yeah, for sure. And to a certain extent, you know, doing drugs kind of makes you feel like you're 15 again, right? Like that's the whole point of it.
I guess it depends on the drug. but. Yes, I have been known to say that weed, at the very least, is the kind of drug that basically just makes everything interesting. Whether it's 3 a.m. World War II black and white documentaries on the History Channel, or, you know, just a flickering fire, just that fire pit on Netflix for 2 hours, just makes everything fascinating. Yeah.
You know, it's that Keanu Reeves thing from like Bill and Ted where you're just like, whoa, that's so cool.
Exactly.
Yeah. No, I get it. But yeah, I tell you, it blew his mind when I gave him that, I'm drunk now, so forgive me, the name of the second book.
Strings.
You know, I gave him that when I picked him up from Boy Scout camp. Last summer, like this summer 2019, before all this bullshit happened. Yeah. And it's like, here, you can read this book before it's even released. And like, I was a hero.
Awesome.
In his mind.
Awesome. So. Yeah. This time the third book I didn't even get before it was released or for several weeks after it was released. So we weren't able to do that this time.
But. He's got to get his grades up. So I showed it to him. I'm like, look, I got this. I'm like, but you know, you got an F in Spanish, so you know, you need to work on that.
Don't
shit.
Tell him. Don't tell him. I dropped out of Spanish in college and took an incomplete to avoid failing.
Well, I've done a few of those
because I skipped so many classes, and I took it the next year again, and I got a C-.
Oh.
So there you go.
Oh wow,
that's my story. This is after taking 4 years of Spanish in high school and getting A's. Well, that's how far I dropped off once I went to college. Yeah.
He kind of like a lot of us, he got fucked over by the pandemic, because he took Spanish 1 and 2 in middle school.
Oh wow!
But it's a high school credit. Like okay, so my oldest kid, he's like a super genius.
That's awesome.
And I have been for years like saying like, okay, that's great, but we need to make sure that he's like Nikolai Tesla and not Lex Luthor.
Thomas Edison even.
or even Thomas Edison, yeah. So he took Spanish 1 and 2 in 7th and 8th grade. So he's in 9th grade now. He's a freshman in high school, and he was taking Spanish 3 with a bunch of, you know, with a bunch of 11th graders. And he, you know, he didn't adjust so well. So he's gonna have to revisit that, but I forgot where I was going with this.
Taking Spanish, I don't know either. I think we've both had too much to drink, and the last time we mentioned One Cut of the Dead was at least 15 minutes ago,
at the very least. But that's okay. It's a good conversation. I should say, you know, I mean, like, we've been friends for a couple of years now.
Yeah.
And, you know, aside from we did meet in person, mm-hmm. the summer before last, July.
Yes.
I think
2019.
I want to say it was July. Yeah. But this is the first time we've ever actually had a chance to like have a conversation.
Yeah. We should do it more often.
We should.
I would like to have you on our podcast just to talk about your experiences, both with modern horrors, but also because you guys have done some indie filmmaking, but also because you're a film reviewer, but also because of the patent stuff. I think there's a bunch of different angles where Chris and Barrett and I could come up with some good questions for you, and you'd make a good guest.
Oh, so sure.
You put that in your brain and stew on it.
Yeah, yeah. I'll do that. Yeah, because right. I mean that sounds fascinating. Yeah. I'd love to.
I think that'd be good.
Big fan of the podcast.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'm curious because the videos are like they're very well produced.
Well, thank you.
So did you have acting experience? Had you done like voiceover work and stuff like that before?
Just radio. I did. There was a radio program at my college. Actually, where I went to college is a little place called Olivet. It's in Kankakee, Illinois, that they have what at the time, I don't know anymore, was a top 25 Christian radio station, a top 25 in the U.S. But the one at Olivet was entirely student run. The guy who taught broadcasting would do the morning show. He is now a voice actor and a very successful one. And then the students would be the DJs. And I did the news on drive time for about a year and a half. I was an AM weekend DJ for a while. And I'm sure that's where a lot of it came from, because there are classes where they literally teach you like how to say W instead of W. Interestingly enough, I took broadcasting with Aaron Dicer, who you might know on Twitter or as one of the CinemaSins writers. We were both students at the same time and both DJs on the same radio station. So I did some acting on stage and some radio work, but no formal training of any kind, baby. I am self-taught.
Okay. Well, listen, I appreciate it, and I definitely appreciate the time, and I want to be respectful of that. So. Yeah, why don't we leave it there?
One Cut of the Dead 4 stars out of 4, 5 stars out of 5. If you are a fan of movies, I think you will like this movie. If you are queasy of stomach and think that the zombie stuff might keep you away from it, I really think the movie shows you how fake it all is so many times that you'll be able to make it through. 2 thumbs up.
Yeah, yeah. I don't think it's like if you, I mean, The Walking Dead, for God's sakes, is on network TV, is on, you know, cable TV.
Way grosser than this movie, for sure. For sure.
Yeah. And so I agree. And it's a great movie about movies. I love movies about movies. I love, you know, Get Shorty. What's the Eddie Murphy one?
Bowfinger.
Bowfinger is a fantastic one. This belongs, I think, in that, at that same level. It's
absolutely
fantastic.
Yeah.
So, okay. Thank you, everyone. Thank you very much, Jeremy, for joining us. I'm sure people already know, but just you know, for the sake of saying, they can find you. They can find you online. They can find you at your podcast. You want to plug those real quick?
Sure. The podcast is SinCast, presented by CinemaSins. That's Spotify, Apple, Pandora, everywhere's podcasts are. You can find me on Twitter at CinemaSins. I think that's basically it. I have nothing left to pimp.
Okay, thanks everybody. Thank you very much. This has been Not Suitable for Anyone. I've been drinking Maker's Mark 101 proof. Just to be completely transparent about it. So I'm hammered, I'm wasted. This is this will be an interesting episode to edit. Anyway, what was I saying? It's not important. One Cut of the Dead, watch it. It's great. It's fantastic. We probably have gone 30 minutes without talking about it, but that's okay. The whole point is, This is a cult film. Other films deserve that same attention. But if on the off chance you have not seen it yet, you definitely need to. It's fantastic. It's a movie about movies. If you like that kind of thing, it belongs up there with the best of them. Check it out. It comes highly recommended from myself, from Mr. Jeremy Scott of CinemaSins, from the other folks at Modern Horrors, Luke Rodriguez, Jake Parker among them. So please check it out, and please tune in next week and weeks down the road. Like I said, I've got some big episodes planned. I'm really happy about it. Christmas is coming. You have no idea how excited I am for Christmas. I'm a big Christmas guy. And more than that, I am a big Christmas horror guy. There's something about taking that season and making it sinister, scary, and bloody that just fascinates me. And I love it. So I'm going to try to throw some Christmas horror episodes together for you. Try to get some indie Christmas horror directors on the line. I think it'll be a lot of fun. I think it'll be great. So I love you. Peace out, Jeremy. Thank you very much again. You've been a fantastic guest.
This was fun. I can't wait to listen to it and see what people have to say.
Take it easy.
You too, buddy. I'll talk to you. I'm sure I'll talk to you before the night's over.
I'm sure. See you.
All right, peace.